Bible reading tonight comes from 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 1 to 9. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them." Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there, while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I have had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. All at once an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you." So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he had reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. This is the word of the Lord.
Our Father, we ask that you would enlighten our eyes this evening. As we look at this prophet who is down in the dumps, we ask that we might learn something anew about you and how you treat your servants when they go through difficulties in life. We thank you for this story. We thank you for the way you teach us and the way that you care for us and the way that you watch over us through all of life. May we leave here this evening having heard a word from you, for Jesus' sake. Amen. A number of years ago now, there was a heart-rending story that was in the press, in the newspaper, of an incident overseas. It was of a young father who shot himself in a tavern telephone booth. James Lee had called a Chicago newspaper and told a reporter that he had sent the paper a manila envelope outlining his story. The reporter frantically tried to trace the call, but was too late. When the police arrived, the young man was slumped in the booth with a bullet through his head. In his pockets, they found a child's crayon drawing, much folded and worn. On it was written, "Please leave in my coat pocket. I want to have it buried with me." The drawing was signed in childish print by his daughter, Shirley Lee, who had perished in a fire just 5 months before. Lee was so grief-stricken, he had asked total strangers to attend his daughter's funeral so she would have a nice service. He said there was no family to attend, since Shirley's mother had been dead since the child was two. Speaking to the reporter before his death, the heartbroken father said that all he had in life was gone, and he felt so alone. He gave his modest estate to the church Shirley had attended and said, "Maybe in 10 or 20 years someone will see one of the plaques and wonder who Shirley Ellen Lee was and say, someone must have loved her very, very much." The grieving father could not stand loneliness or the loss, so he took his own life. He felt it better to be dead than live in an impersonal world. What a tragic story. And yet, suicide is something we really have to face in our society, isn't it? It's tragic when it happens. We've experienced it in this church. And other churches I know have experienced it. There was a church close to us whose youth pastor committed suicide. Evan, I hope you're okay. But it is tragic. When a person gets to the point at which there is no point for them wanting to live anymore, where things have become so heavy, so hard to deal with, that there is no want to continue to live in a world. And sometimes we can be a little bit too quick to judge those who commit suicide. Yes, I know that at one level it can be quite selfish, and ultimately it is rather selfish because the person is only thinking of themselves. But at another level, we have to understand that sometimes the sweep of emotions that pours over a person and the irrationality of their thought processes at that point just is so overwhelming that they can't think like you and I. They can't think like a rational person. And so all of that emotion just floods over them, and they make irrational, emotive decisions that can't be undone. That as a rational thinking person, we may say, how can someone do something like that? And he lodges at that point. I mean, here is a man who's celebrated Mount Carmel. Here is a guy who's come from the mountaintop. God has revealed himself in fire. The altar has been burned up. The sacrifice has been burned. Israel have bowed down and cried out, Yahweh Elohei, the Lord, He is God. They are worshipping God. They have seen a demonstration of God's great power. And now Elijah flees for his life, and he is despondent and dejected, and he's down in the dumps, and all he wants to do is die. Maybe you felt like that. Maybe God's speaking to you who's feeling like that right now. Maybe there's someone in this congregation, though you would not admit it to those around you, and though you may hide it from others, you're going through an inner turmoil in your own life. And life for you right now is quite bleak. And maybe you've reached the point where there are moments, though you hate to admit it, where you too feel like giving up on life, where things have not worked out the way you had hoped, where your plans have fallen apart, and you're an emotional mess inside, and there's all kinds of turmoil and burdens you're feeling, and you're not at liberty to perhaps share those around. And you're bottling it all up, and inside you're down in the dumps, like Elijah, despondent and dejected. Maybe you've been there at some point in life. I know for myself that I can say that last year was one of the most difficult, in fact was the most difficult I've ever experienced in ministry. And there were times where I was deep down in the dumps. And there were times I would have been quite happy for God to have said, that's it, your life's over, I'm taking it. It would have been a relief from some of the burdens that were being carried. And maybe you feel like that. Lord, death would be a welcome intrusion in my life right now. It would deliver me out of this world that is filled with so much pain and so much heartache and so much that I have to bear, and the trials that I have to walk through, and the waters that are so deep. And Lord, maybe it would be better for me to be gone. And God's brought you here tonight because He's got a word for you. Because He wants to speak into the depths of your situation and give you hope. Come with me to the text. Firstly, I want you to notice Elijah's strange path, verses 1 to 3. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. I want to pause just there. It's an interesting verse. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done. Do you see the problem with the focus of that verse? When Ahab goes back to his wife Jezebel, he's not reporting what God has done through Elijah, but he's reporting what the prophet has done. The focus is all wrong, because the issue on Mount Carmel has got nothing to do with Elijah. And we saw that in the second part of the prayer, almost identical to the first prayer. The issue is what God is doing through Elijah. And Ahab doesn't get it. And it's all about Elijah, and it's all about the strife that Elijah is bringing. And it's all about the problems that Elijah has caused. And his focus is totally wrong. It should have been on God. It should have been about God's glorious revelation of His power and His sovereignty. But it's not. It's about Elijah. And even in that, you see, there is a corollary effect upon Elijah. Because ultimately, when we boil it all down, and when Elijah gets to that prayer in the desert, as we will get to, I don't want to get ahead of myself, it is ultimately a statement of pride. poor me. Look what I've gone through. Why hasn't it all worked out the way it should have worked out? And part of the problem is that the focus is too much on Elijah. Notice what she says. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. Now Elijah's standing at the gate, remember, he's run ahead of Ahab. May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that, like one of them. Instead of being moved by God, her heart is hardened. It just increases her resolve. 450 of her prophets have been slaughtered. And instead of seeing the miracle of what God has done on that mountain, and instead of bowing down before God, she simply resists even more and becomes more determined to kill Elijah. So she sends the message, Elijah, your life is going to be like this. In other words, you're dead meat. Now you would think that Elijah at that point would once again, as he has done in the past, seek a word from God. But he doesn't. He responds in a way that is totally inconsistent with his faith. He turns and he begins to run. And let me tell you, he runs. This is Elijah not just running some short distance. But if the distance from where he goes to and where he runs to is right as far as the crow flies. Now, I'm not a good geographer. My wife is very good at geography. That's her speciality, so I'm loath to tramp on her field. But if I've got my distances right, he runs for about 150 Ks. Now, he's got no Nike running shoes. He's running in old sandals, so it's not as if he's got any assistance, but he runs and he flees for his life. Isn't that so inconsistent? I mean, here is a prophet who's faced 450 prophets of Baal, has boldly proclaimed that Yahweh is God, has a nation that has gathered on that mountain, fall down on their knees and proclaim Yahweh is God. And the first sign of trouble, he turns and he runs. It's just so inconsistent. From being bold, he has become a coward. You see, the problem is, he turns his eyes off God and he begins to focus on his circumstances and he allows his circumstances to overwhelm him. So that now it's all about his own life and how he's going to escape. It's not about how God can look after him. It's not about how this miracle working God who has done this incredible miracle on Mount Carmel can protect him and shield him and stop Jezebel from accomplishing her purposes. He's suddenly become inward focused and it's all about the plight that he finds himself in. It's all about me. It's all about everyone's against me and all of this has been a waste of time. And so he allows the circumstances to become overwhelming in his life and crush him. And his immediate response is, I want to get out of here as fast as I can and as far away as I can. Have you felt like that at times? Where you've just wanted to say, I've had enough of life. It's just become too much for me. And if only I could get out myself out of these circumstances. It's, Lord, I can't bear it anymore. How much longer do I have to endure this opposition? How much longer do I have to endure this pain? How much longer, Lord, do I have to suffer? I mean, when are you going to alleviate it? When are you going to remove it? I mean, how much, Lord? Elijah's feeling like that, and his response is to say, I've had enough. He's not the only one who suffered like that. Remember Exodus chapter 4, verses 1 to 15. Where God raises up Moses and calls him in that burning bush. And Moses comes up with every excuse under the book. And eventually says to the Lord, send someone else. It's too big for me. Oh, remember Peter in Luke 22, 56 to 62. I won't read the verses. You can read them for yourself. Luke 22, 56 to 62, where Peter, who has boldly, prior to the crucifixion of Christ, looked Jesus in the eyes and said, Jesus, they may all depart from you, but me, never. I'll stand. I'll never forsake you. I'll never desert you. And then the moment he's faced with opposition, and the moment he is put on the spot, and the moment his faith comes under focus and the relationship with Jesus is highlighted, what does Peter do? He crumbles. He has this man who has boldly said, "Lord, I'll stick with you. I'll stay with you to the end." And he just breaks under pressure. He's not alone. Sometimes even the strongest people of faith have flaws and weaknesses. And God reminds us of that by exposing these flaws and weaknesses in His Word. One of the beauties about God's Word is He doesn't just hold up the heroes and never tell us about their faults. But God exposes the heroes of faith with all their faults and all their weaknesses and all their frailties and fallibilities. Because it is a reminder to us that as strong as we may be in our faith, all of us have an Achilles heel. All of us have frailties. All of us may fail from time to time. All of us may fall down. All of us may want to at times give up and just throw in the towel. We're not alone. And no matter how well you might be going now, no matter how on top of things you may be feeling, let God introduce a fiery trial into your life. Let God turn up the heat. And then let's see how you respond. Or what if you're undergoing that trial right now and it's been going on for 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe even longer? How's your faith doing? Have you felt like throwing in the towel? Have you felt like saying, "Lord, I've had enough. Christianity was never meant to be this hard. I want to give up." Even Spurgeon went through something like that. That great man of faith who had such an incredible ministry over 40 years at the same church. When there was a fire that broke out in Exeter Hall when they were away and they were redoing their building, and a number of people got killed in the stampede to get out of the building. Someone cried fire. There was no fire. And in the rush to get out, some people were killed. Spurgeon went through an incredible depression following that, to the point where he almost walked away from ministry. Even the great men of God's faith go through difficulty. So don't get down and despondent if you're there right now. You're quite normal. You're not different to anyone else. Secondly, I want you to notice Elijah's strange prayer, verses 4 and 5a. He came to a broom tree, sat under it, and prayed that he might die. "I've had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. If we understand that prayer correctly, if we hear the complaint or the burden of his heart, remembering now that he's traveled probably another 40-50 k, so altogether this journey has amounted to about 200 k, and he comes to the desert and he lies down under a broom tree which is probably around about 3 meters tall. And there he looks towards heaven and he says, "Lord, I've had enough. I'm no better than my ancestors." And if we hear him correctly, what he's saying is, "Lord, I've endeavored to do what they have done. You sent them out to call them back to yourself. I've been faithful in ministry, Lord. I've labored long and hard." He's going to eventually say to the Lord, "I'm the only prophet left." And the Lord's going to say, "No, you're not." But he thinks he is. "I am alone in this endeavor, Lord. I've strived. I've struggled. You revealed yourself on Mount Carmel. There was this great cry from Israel. But now look, it meant absolutely nothing. I'm back to the same position I was prior to going to Mount Carmel. I was living abroad. I was living with a widow. I was outside of the borders of Israel. I was in Samaria. Now I'm back in the same place. I'm fleeing again. I'm all alone again. There's no one to help me. My ministry is an utter failure. Have you felt like that? Where you look at the effort you've put in, and you've given yourself, and you've given over and above what is normal. You've sacrificed, you've used your own resources, you've labored long and hard for God, and you've seen so little change in the lives of people. You've prayed, you've cried for people, you've sought to care and support. You sought to be faithful to God, and yet it seems as though nothing changes. Lord, why aren't their lives being transformed? Why is there so little spiritual progress, Lord? Why do I labor and labor and labor? And yet all it seems is that I fail and fail and fail, and Lord, I'm so weak and so inadequate. Is there ever going to be any change? He's despondent. He's dejected. What's the point? And sometimes ministry can be like that. Sometimes you can look, because what happens in people's lives is happening internally. How do you measure that? You know, when you mow your lawn, you can see the results of the lawn being mowed. And a week later, you're mowing it again. But you can see, visibly, you can see. But when you're ministering in a spiritual sense, sometimes it's so difficult to see changes. Lord, have I spent all these years ministering, and yet, what's happened? What's been accomplished in your name? Has anything been accomplished? It's so easy to evaluate ministry only in what we see, failing to realize that God is at work in ways that we cannot see. And He is accomplishing His purposes for His honor and His glory, even though we might not visibly see that. And perhaps it's only in heaven one day, when we stand before God, that God will reveal to us all that He managed to accomplish through the faithfulness of His weak servants. It's so easy to become dejected like Elijah did. Coupled to all of that, there's an emotional drain that's happened. You know what it's like sometimes where you're involved in some kind of project, and that project comes to an end. I was just speaking to two guys after the service this morning, just saying to me, you know, they go overseas and they accomplish and they do these projects and they come back and they've been on this high, and the next day or two they go down into the dumps. It's like that sometimes, isn't it? And you feel as though, you know, I've been let down. Well, that's Elijah. He's had this incredible emotional high. And Jezebel says, you're dead meat. It's all just swept out, taken away from him under his feet. What's the point, Lord? What's the point? I'm done. I'm finished. I'm through. No more. I've had enough. It would be better for me to die. I've been no better than my forebears. They too have labored. They too have struggled. And they too have met the stubborn, stiff-necked people who refuse to change. And in effect, Elijah is saying, Lord, my ministry has come to an end. I'm done. I'm through. And I want to tell you, I've been there. Thank goodness God doesn't leave us there. The only sense that he makes is he turns towards God and he prays. That's the only good thing. Even though he says, take my life. And yet God answers his prayer, but not in the way that Elijah expects him to answer. God answers his prayer in a completely different way. He understands the plight of his servant. And so he gives him the right answer. But I want you to notice the honesty of this man before God. And you know, don't be scared of telling God where you're at. Don't be scared of coming before God and saying, Lord, I feel as though I'm done, I'm through. Because God understands your heart. God understands the tears. God understands the pain. God understands the frustration you may feel. God understands that you may feel as though you've got to the end of your tether. He knows. And he doesn't condemn you for it. Jeremiah, when he's thrown into the well, into the stocks by Pasha the priest, and in Jeremiah 20 verses 7 and 8, comes before God and says, oh Lord, it feels like you've raped me. Literally, that's what he says. You've overpowered me. It's a sexual word. As in person who's been raped. And I couldn't resist. I couldn't stop you. You've done all this, Lord. I've had enough. Or Jonah, who wants to die. Or Job, in chapter 10, verses 18 to 22. Why then did you bring me out of the womb? I wish I'd died before any eye saw me. If only I'd never come into being, or had been carried straight away from the womb to the grave. Are not my few days almost over? Turn away from me, so that I can have a moment's joy. Because you see, if God turns away from him, he's dead. Before I go to the place of no return, to the land of gloom and deep shadow, to the land of the deepest night of deep shadow and disorder, where even the light is darkness, here is a man who's had enough. What about Psalm 88? The only psalm in the entire Bible, in the Old Testament, that ends on a negative note. Oh Lord, the God who saves me, day and night I cry out before you. May my prayer come before you. Turn my ear to my cry, for my soul is so full of trouble and my life draws near the grave. I won't read the whole thing. And you know how he ends? Verse 18. You have taken my companions and loved ones from me. They've all died. And the darkness is my closest friend. Can you hear the depths of despair in that? The darkness is my closest friend. William Cowper's poetic achievements are remarkable in the light of the fact that his mental illness plagued him all his life. The son of a chaplain to King George II, William worked as a lawyer for several years. At age 32, he was nominated to a position that required public examination. He grew fearful of that and tried to commit suicide three times and nearly succeeded. During his stay of 18 months in the asylum at St. Albans, however, Cowper was converted while reading Romans. And if you want to hear more about Romans, come to the morning service. After his release, Cowper resided in Huntingdon with the family of a Reverend Unwin. And upon Unwin's death, John Newton came to comfort the family, and he convinced Mrs. Unwin and her children and Cowper to move to Olney, where he lived. The prayer at Olney was a time of healing and spiritual growth for Cowper. Newton urged Cowper to serve Olney's poor, probably in an effort to take Cowper's mind off his depression, his poor health, paranoia, and fears of damnation. He also convinced Cowper to write hymns for the parish prayer meetings. The result was the Olney Hymns of 1779, which contained 348 hymns, 68 by Cowper, who suffered a relapse and was unable to finish the work. Three of his best known works are, There is a Fountain Filled with Blood Drawn from Emmanuel's Veins, Safely Through Another Week, and Oh for a Closer Walk with Thee. His famous hymn, God Moves in Mysterious Ways His Wonders to Perform, was written about the time of another bout of mental illness, during which Cowper attempted again suicide. Despite this, John Newton said of him, I can hardly form an idea of a closer walk with God than he uniformly maintained. Cowper did not begin his literary career until the age of 50. There's hope for me. His translations of Homer and poems such as John Gilpin placed him at the forefront of English poets, and his literary, and it is the literary Cowper now listed in reference books. Perhaps Cowper's most meaningful words were the hymns written during fits of despair. It is said that on his deathbed he stated, "I am not shut out after heaven after all." In the moments of despair and heartache, take it to the Lord in prayer. And then thirdly, why does time go so quickly? I want you to notice God's shepherding response. God's shepherding response, verses 5b to 8. I won't read them for the sake of time. But notice how God deals with Elijah. "Lord, take my life." God says, "No, Elijah, I'm not going to take your life. Aren't you grateful that when you pray, the answers that God gives you are always right? And they were always according to his purposes. If I got the answers to all my prayers, I would have been dead long time ago because I prayed that prayer in times of despair." But God doesn't take him at that prayer. God says, "No, Elijah, there's work left for you to do. I understand you, Elijah. I know how despairing you feel. I know how difficult the difficulties you have faced. I know how frustrated you are that it seems as though so little is being accomplished. I understand how hard ministry can be. I know how you plow and plow and plow, and yet so often it seems as though the ground is not fallow and so hard and not receiving all the plowing and the seed that you are planting. I know that, Elijah. And while you think you are that nothing is being accomplished through the ministry that you exercise, I want you to know, Elijah, that I've still got work for you. Because I am at work. You may not understand it, you may not see it, Elijah, but I am working on your behalf. And I'm still accomplishing my purposes. And you are still the instrument that I desire to use in the accomplishment of those purposes. Elijah, don't give up just yet." So what does God do? He ministers very practically to his physical needs. The poor guy hasn't eaten for a while. He's hungry. And he's thirsty. He's in the desert. And so what does God do? He provides an angel, another miraculous response. There have been two others, where he fed him with ravens by the brook, where he fed him in the widow's house at Zarephath by the oil and the grain. And now he feeds Elijah through the appearance of an angel who brings practically food. The poor guy is hungry. And now God is going to send him on a 400K journey. It's going to take him 40 days and nights. No chariot. And God prepares him. And you know what God's going to do? He's going to take him through the desert on the way to the mountain, Mount Horeb. And you know why he takes him to Mount Horeb? Because that is the mountain where the people first committed themselves to God. And as he takes Elijah through the desert, you know what he's going to do? He's going to remind him of the wilderness wanderings. He's going to remind him of how he sustained the people. He's going to remind them of how he protected them, how he shepherded them, how he led them. He's going to remind them that he is still at work in the same way that he was at work back then. And that in the same way that Moses at times got frustrated and Moses at times lost his cool and looked at the people and didn't want to continue, he's going to remind them that he was still at work in that situation. He brought his people safely into Canaan, and so he takes them to that important mountain, Horeb, Mount Sinai, where it all began. And he wants effectively to say, "Elijah, there's lots left to do. Aren't you glad that in your time of desperation that God doesn't turn his back on you? That God doesn't give up on you? That God says, 'My dear child, in spite of the burden you've got, I am able to minister the right kind of grace that you need for that particular burden.'" And God is a very practical God. God is able to keep your feet and keep your eyes open. He's able to keep your feet on solid ground. He's able to sustain you even though it may not feel like it. Even though it may feel as though God has abandoned you. It is only when you look back and you reflect on the hand of God upon your life that you can see how God's all-sufficient grace has indeed sustained you. In the words of the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 12 verse 9b, "Your grace is sufficient for me. Your power is made perfect when in weakness, when I don't feel it anymore. I know that it's there. Because you are a God who shepherds me, who cares for me as a shepherd cares for his sheep, who sustains and provides for me, who enables me to continue when I have no energy left in myself to continue, when I've reached the end of the road, when it seems like it's just hurdle after hurdle after hurdle, even then you enable me to keep on going. And it's not me who does this, it's you who do it through me. For God loves his children. And God cares for them so deeply and so intimately. And God is able to sustain them through the fiercest drought and through the most perplexing and difficult of circumstances. God never abandons his children. He never gives them up. He never gets exasperated to the point where he says, "Oh, I'm so tired of this. You're at this point again in your life. I'm so sick of it." God never does that. That's not the kind of God he is. But he takes his wounded and weary children. And he says, "Come unto me, you who are burdened and heavy laden." And he sustains, and he empowers, and he enables. Aren't you so grateful for a God like that? God's not finished with you yet. I don't know where you're at. I don't know how deep it might be, but God's not finished with you yet. Sergei was a Russian man who had found Christ and wanted to escape. He was part of the KGB out of Russia in the 60s. Got onto a trawler ship. Got it off the Canadian coast where it had moored. Had dived into this icy, freezing cold water. And had began to swim towards freedom. The water was icy. He had trained for this. He had done weights. He had got fit. But he knew he had a certain amount of time before he would freeze. And he would die from hypothermia. And as he made his way towards the shore, after I don't know how many minutes, I've read the book, I can't forget, I remember the exact amount of time. He tried to get an idea of where his bearings were. And as he looked around, he saw the lights of the ship and yet swam in a circle. Feeling the energy drain from his body, feeling weak and wondering how on earth he was ever going to make it, he turned his eyes towards heaven and he said, "Lord, help me." He said, "I began to swim and suddenly I knew the direction I needed to swim in, and I had a strength that I no longer thought I had." He was found the following day washed up on the shore, alive. Where are you at this evening? Are you in need of God's ministering grace? Are you in need of God's sustaining power? Are you in need from a touch from God? He says, "My child, I love you so much. I've got you here for a purpose. There's work left for you to do. Hang in there. My grace is sufficient for you."